Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. On this week where we had the first presidential debate, we did a whole podcast about that, and we encourage you to listen to that as well. But this is a conversation we recorded before that debate happened. It's one of our favorite conversations we've done in a while with Jon Favreau, the host of one of the most popular podcasts in the country, Pod Save America. We visited him at Crooked Media and did this at their podcast studio, so it very much sounds like their podcast because they helped us and we used their equipment. Really enjoyed this conversation, talked about their new book, talked about all sorts of things that are happening in politics now, and some great stories about Barack Obama and about John's journey. So here's Jon Favreau.
Jon Favreau, welcome to The Issue Is, and thank you for having us here at Crooked.
Thanks for coming, and thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, we love that Crooked is here in California, and it often gives us an opportunity to mooch off your guests. So we appreciate that as well when people come in to do your show. The book is great, Democracy or Else, and How to Save America in 10 Steps. I read the whole thing. It's fun. It's fast. It's funny.
Yeah.
It's like every other sentence seems to be a joke.
Tried to keep it light.
It's the textbook I wish I had when I was taking poli-sci class, and I think it's really inviting for a whole lot of people. Even if you're not a liberal, I think it's really written as a way to get you more involved in politics. Why do you think that a book like this is necessary?
I mean, we started Pod Save America back in 2017 because after Donald Trump won, a lot of people who hadn't been involved in politics, hadn't really even paid attention to politics, and some Democrats, some Republicans, some people who just weren't either, said, you know, we're scared about what's happening with the country. We want to get involved, but we're not sure how we'd be most useful, where to start. And, you know, the pod for the last several years has been trying to help people understand that politics doesn't have to be as scary and confusing as it may seem, mm-hmm. and that getting involved is easier and more useful than you might think. Mm-hmm. And we also had the opportunity to talk to so many people who are smarter than us and more experienced than us, and whether it's strategists, politicians, organizers, activists. And so we wanted to include their lessons in the book, our lessons in the book, and just sort of put it all on paper because we've been talking into microphones for all these years, but we figured it'd be good to get it into a book.
Yeah, and that is the best part about hosting a show is that you do get to talk to people smarter than you, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to talk to you, to learn from you. And the book starts with this idea of being prepared and getting informed, and goes into the very challenging dynamic that we're in right now in terms of our media landscape, which has changed so much even in the last few years.
Yes.
For people that are confused on what do I believe, what do I not believe, where should I go, what do you say?
I mean, I still think mainstream news sources, your New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post.
The Issue Is.
The Issue, of course.
Yes.
Those are going to be the sources that you can still count on, even though they don't have the reach they used to have. That's, of course, part of the issue. Mm-hmm. But that's where you can. And I also would advise people to, you know, go seek out news sources that don't necessarily confirm your own beliefs. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, like, go on social media and just find someone saying the opposite. Like, there are good news sources that are that I might not agree with always. I don't know. I don't agree with the Wall Street Journal editorial page all the time, but I still think that the Wall Street Journal is a good news organization. Go, like, seek out those views. And also, if you see something and it strikes you as surprising, mm-hmm. like, go find a couple other sources that are saying it as well. You know, don't just take one tweet and think that that's the news and start sharing it. So I think you've got to be in this media environment. You've sometimes it's tempting to, like, consume everything or to just, like, go after whatever is new and trending. And the reality is you're still going to be better off and you're going to be better informed if you go and seek, like, straight news sources that have editors and institutional support behind them, and, like, that's where you're going to get your best news.
Right, this idea that you actually have to fact check, the idea that you could get sued if you don't get it right, that some of these random online X accounts don't have all of that and may not be experts in that space.
And you hear us on the pod all the time. Like, I make sure when I'm writing the script for Pod Save America, that if I'm giving people information from somewhere, I'm citing the source, I'm letting them know what it is. And, you know, we're liberal and we have a viewpoint, but I think that it's not contradictory to have a political partisan point of view and still provide people with information that is credible and truthful.
So you're the messaging guy. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you were the speechwriter for Obama. And one of the things you talk about in terms of messaging here is the challenge of talking to people that really aren't that into politics, which, by the way, is most people.
Most
people aren't like us. We're weird in that space.
Yes.
And there's a lot of people, especially with this election, that don't like the two presidential candidates and are thinking about sitting this one out. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the way to talk to them. What's your best advice for people to try to bring them into the fold a little bit?
It's a great question. I think oftentimes when we think about how to communicate with people, we think about it in terms of, what do I need to say to them? What do I need to tell them? And I think a lot of the most impactful and persuasive conversations start with listening and asking someone, what do you care about? What issues are on your mind? What concerns do you have about political issues that may affect you, that may affect your family, that may affect your community or the country? And then go in from that way and do it from there. And I, you know, we tell a story in the book about this woman who we had interviewed for another podcast I do called The Wilderness. And she was in Western Pennsylvania, in a pretty conservative red area of Pennsylvania. She's liberal. And after the 2016 elections, in advance of the midterms, she was door knocking. And she encountered this, House Trump flag, talked to this woman, definitely a Trump supporter. And instead of saying, like, you know, I'm from the resistance and we're trying to elect Democrats, you know, she said, what do you care about? And she said, well, I care about the high cost of prescription drugs. And I think, and she goes, yeah, me too. She goes, I have MS and I'm worried about healthcare. And she's like, yeah, and I think that the pharmaceutical companies are like charging too much. And she's like, me too. Mm-hmm. And they had this nice conversation about healthcare where they realized that they agreed on a lot more than they thought. Mm-hmm. And in addition to perhaps convincing that woman to see things from another political point of view, it also just built trust between the two of them. And I think that right now, when most of the people who might not participate in this election have such little trust and faith in institutions, making sure they hear from trusted messengers and making sure that you can be a trusted messenger is probably going to be the most important thing in terms of trying to persuade them to see things differently.
And you make the argument that talking to a neighbor or somebody in your community is far more influential and persuadable than some random schmuck.
Yes.
That's even calling you on the phone or something like that. Although that story reminded me of an experience that I had when I was in college and I was doing door knocking. And I remember asking, are you voting for John Kerry? And the guy said, I'm voting to shoot John Kerry. And I said, undecided. I think we got the data wrong on this one.
But I've gotten plenty of those too.
Yeah, yeah.
I did telemarketing for a newspaper in high school.
Okay.
So you can imagine how many hang-ups and expletives I dealt with.
From a different media environment.
Yes.
You also talk about organizing and the importance of that, and the importance of organizing for the races beyond the president that are really important. And especially here in California,
mm-hmm.
the House races are crucial.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens in terms of a few districts in California could determine whether Democrats or Republicans control the House. How are you thinking about that, and what will maybe be the involvement of Vote Save America when it comes to some of those California House races?
Yes, it's a great question. In 2018, as part of Vote Save America, which is our organization that encourages people to sign up, volunteer, donate, we had something called the Crooked Seven, which were the seven districts, the House districts in California then, that we thought we could flip from Republican to Democrat. And we focused a lot of our efforts on those districts. And I think, again, between California and New York, you have enough competitive House districts just in those two blue states that could flip the House to Democrats. And, you know, I think in 2022, while Democrats did better than expected in the Senate races, you know, I think in especially in New York, some of these House races, you know,
mm-hmm.
we didn't focus
that was the difference.
Intensely enough on. So I do think it's nice because we're here in Los Angeles, like, we can go to these districts, right? Like the 25th is, you know, just an hour north. We've been down to Orange County, to a bunch of those districts.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, did door knocking with Katie Porter back in 2018 and some of the candidates down there. So we'll, you know, because I think it's a benefit of being in Los Angeles that a lot of our listeners who are also here will volunteer in some of these districts around L.A.
One of the other things you talk about in the book, Democracy or Else, is your own journey into politics. Starting as a kid, working on the Kerry campaign, and wanting to be a speechwriter and thinking I can be a speechwriter and sort of kind of lucking, forcing your way into that a little bit.
I did. I was on the Kerry campaign 2 weeks out of college. I was a press assistant on the Kerry campaign. I moved down to D.C. I had an internship in his Senate office when I was in college. And I was the press assistant, so I got everyone lunches and coffees, and I did all the grunt work. And then at one point, the chief speechwriter moved from L.A., Andre Cherney, and he's now running for Congress in Arizona. And they sat him right next to me in the office in D.C., and I bugged him like the way that 21-year-old interns bug the people that they work for. And I was like, do you need any help as a speechwriter? And he was nice enough. And then he needed a deputy speechwriter. And I said, oh, can I apply for the job? And I finally got the courage to ask him. And he immediately said no. He's like, no, you don't have the experience. You're right out of college. Fast forward a couple months later, John Kerry is losing to Howard Dean in the primary, had to mortgage his house to keep the campaign going. And so they couldn't afford to hire a real speechwriter, and not a lot of people wanted to join that primary campaign because they thought it was a sinking ship. So they looked around and they're like, all right, I guess we can make Favreau the junior speechwriter because we're not going to have to pay him more than the $24,000 a year that I was making at the time. So that's how I got the job. And then Kerry wins the primary and, you know, I stayed on through the general.
And then a few years later, there's this young upstart senator and your old boss in the campaign, right? Robert Gibbs said,
yes,
come work for us, for this guy named Barack Obama.
Yes, he did. And my first meeting with Obama did not go as well because I was at the 2004 convention in Boston where he gave the keynote address, and I was working for the Kerry campaign. And the chief speechwriter called me from the road and said, you know, there's a line in the speech, the keynote address being delivered by State Senator Barack Obama that John Kerry wants to use in his speech. And I was like, so? He's like, well, we're going to need you to go take that line out of the speech and tell him he needs to change the line. And I'm like, what? So I'm 21, walk down the hall. Barack Obama's practicing the 2004 convention speech on teleprompter for the first time. I walk up to Gibbs. I was like, he needs to change the line. I tell him the whole thing. Gibbs is like, I'm not telling him. You go tell him. So I introduce myself. I tell him, you know, this line. Well, and Obama just is like an inch from my face. And he goes, are you trying to tell me I have to take out my favorite line in this speech? And I think I like lost consciousness for a few seconds. And when I came to, I met David Axelrod, and he said, son, let's walk outside and we'll rewrite the line together.
What was the line?
The line was at the end of the, there are no red states, blue states, only the United States. And originally it was red, white, and blue.
Oh.
And John Kerry wanted to use red, white, and blue, and so we gave it to
John. So was it better the way that you did?
Honestly,
I think it turned out to be a
it turned
you,
out
you
it turned out
up.
Better. And then the best part was months later when I sat down for the job interview with Obama in the Senate office, he didn't remember that I was the kid that took the line out, so he hired me.
And then, of course, you become the speechwriter, one of the most famous speechwriters in American history for one of the more popular presidents, and. What do you think is the most important lesson you learned from Barack Obama?
Yeah, it's a great question. I had to relearn lessons that I had learned on the Kerry campaign, and not just because of John Kerry, because most politicians, Democratic politicians, Republican politicians, I think looked at speeches, and still look to some extent at speeches as a collection of sound bites and applause lines.
Mm.
And Obama, in that 2004 convention speech that he wrote himself, because he didn't have a speechwriter before me, he told a story. And, you know, the first couple minutes of that speech, there are no applause lines because he's talking about his story, how it fits in with the larger American story. And he wasn't thinking about, I got to get them to clap here and I got to get the press to write this. Somebody was just like, the story is more important than the words. And he taught me that. And I learned that from him. And over the next 8 years, you know, sometimes it frustrated our comms people that we didn't have like a quotable line in the speech.
Right.
But that's, I think it, you know, we we are moved and persuaded by stories, by emotion, more so than just facts and figures. And that is how he, you know, communicated with people. And I do think that more politicians would be better off if that's how they communicate.
This goes back to like cavemen drawing stories.
Absolutely.
But do you think that would work now with our attention span, which is even shorter than it was in 2008?
It is. I've thought about that many times in the last couple of years, is what will become of speech writing. I still think you see this on YouTube all the time. People like tune in for hours, right?
Or
like
listen to your show, right? Pod Save America.
If they don't
stay with you, you're out of business.
And we try to keep it like, you know, 45. Like Joe Rogan's going like 3 hours, you know. And so if the content feels authentic, and it is authentic, and it just sounds conversational, and it's like striking a chord with someone, people will they will spend the time with it. And look, that still means that I'm aware that people are still consuming a lot of news and political information in very short clips. So you have to do all of that. But I think that you shouldn't try to communicate or write necessarily just for the medium. Mm-hmm. You've got to start with what's the story I want to tell. And then you can figure out how to shape that so that it fits within maybe a shorter clip or whatever else.
It seems like we're in this weird moment where people's attention span is either 3 seconds or 3 hours.
I know.
Right? And the in-between, they're like, they aren't there. They're like scrolling or let's just stay with this forever.
Well, because it's so hard to just capture people's attention.
Right.
And once you have their attention, you can do it, but it takes a while to get that.
There's one story that I thought was really great in the book, which you tell about the White House Correspondents' Dinner that you were writing with your pal and co-host now, John Lovett.
Yeah.
And this is the famous speech where he both goes after Donald Trump and was busy doing something else on the side, but couldn't tell you what he was doing.
Yeah, the day of the correspondent speech, we were very excited about the speech. Had all these Donald Trump jokes. Obama had just finally flew out his birth certificate, gave a press gave a press conference to talk about the birth certificate. And so we had all these jokes about Trump, and Lovett and me were in the outside the Oval Office. We're waiting for our meeting with Obama to go over the jokes one more time. And Obama's personal secretary, our friend Katie, is like, he's in there with, you know, he's got a national security call. He's talking to a general. And we're like, huh, the speech is in a couple hours. We got to get in there, you know, and we're like all annoyed. And finally, he opens the door, and he's in a great mood. He's very relaxed, and we're sitting there, and he's like, I love all the jokes. I'm really excited for this. He goes, there's one punchline where the punchline is Bin Laden. He goes, and I think we need like another sort of global bad guy, autocrat, whatever. And he's like, how about Hosni Mubarak? You know, and I'm like, that's not as funny.
It doesn't work.
You know? And he's like, trust me. And then right before the speech, he called me and he was like, can you add? And he's like, I'll probably remember this on my own, but just add at the end a line that says, you know, God bless America and may God keep our troops safe. And I was like, that's odd. He never told me to do that before. Mm. And sure enough, we learned the next day that the call he was on before us was with General McRaven to give the final go-ahead for the mission to get Bin Laden. So he had to deal with he was dealing with us jokers while he was you know probably giving the green light for one of the most important missions our military has done in some time
on a weekend where he both killed Bin Laden and gave birth to the Donald Trump
campaign. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we went one for two on
it was,
that.
It was a very big weekend. Yeah. So you write about in the book sort of a guide if you want to be a candidate yourself and the value of running.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about it?
Yeah.
Yourself?
I've definitely thought about it. And then the longer I've been in politics, the more I'm like, it's just, I don't think it's for me, you know, because, and I always feel weird because I encourage young people, I encourage everyone, if you know, we need more good people to run for office desperately. And I worry that, like, all the normal people who would excel most at running for office don't want to do it because it's so ugly.
Right.
I think for me now, like I've seen what it does to someone's schedule, you know, and I've seen it with Obama's schedule and Kerry's schedule. And I have two young kids and a wife who I've already like over the last several years had to tell, I got another pod, I got more traveling. So I think it's just, you know, and I'm also very cognizant of like my own background, history, resume, and like, you know, you want people out there who sort of represent the diversity of America in terms of views and backgrounds and everything else. And so, you know, I'll continue to encourage and help anyone else who wants to run for office
to
do it.
You got a pretty good gig here.
Yeah.
So we're talking to Jon Favreau, the author, co-author of Democracy or Else. And one of the things you talk about in this book is the importance of taking a break from all the politics, because it gets to be way too much. And you are married and you've got two young kids.
Yeah.
How has your wife, Emily, and your kids changed you?
It's a great question. I mean, having kids is certainly the biggest life change there has ever been. Like, it's, you know, people say, oh, you go through transitions in high school to college and marriage. Nothing compared to having kids. And now, you know, my eldest son, Charlie, is almost four. And I find, as much as parenting is challenging and exhausting, when I am just hanging out with him and I can put the phone down and not think about politics, like, that is a break.
And can you do a real break?
I'm still very tired, but it for, like, mentally, it's a break. And it's also like, you know, I get to, there's a different skill required, right? I'm teaching him about the world, and now he talks, and we have these great conversations, and it's wonderful. And it's funny, because I didn't think, when Emily first said she was pregnant, I was like, oh God, this could be a huge mistake. I don't know if I'm gonna be a parent. I got politics to deal with. I don't have time for this kid thing. And now I'm like obsessed with them. Obsessed.
That's your world.
Yeah, for sure.
A couple quick news of the day thing before we wrap up. You're the messaging guy. You help craft messages. And right now, the Democrats are struggling with the message over President Biden's age.
Yeah.
I know you were at the fundraiser that Obama and Biden were both at. I was there covering it as the pool reporter. And I will say, privately, many of the Democrats coming out were like, oof, looked really old. You know, like, Obama, not the best comparison. And they were concerned. Mm. They wouldn't say it on camera, but they were concerned. Obviously, this is something you have to talk about on camera. What's your advice in terms of the messaging over President Biden's age?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great... First of all, I would say, I know everyone's, like, scared of saying it, but it's like, yeah, he's old. And, like, he looks old. I was at that fundraiser, and he was very tired. He just came from the G7, and he flew right from Italy to L.A., so it was, like, an insane
and
schedule.
And the press corps, by the way, was exhausted, too. They were, like, zombies, the ones that were traveling.
He's not going to be as good when he's that tired. Yeah. And, like, that's just – I don't – acknowledging that, to me, does not equate with saying, oh, so he's not up for the job, and it's bad, and we're going to hurt his chances. And, you know, I know that there's this, like, big fight – the week this happened over, like, deceptively edited videos of him freezing or not. And, like, I don't think he froze. I saw him. I was a couple rows in, and I saw him, like, looking at the audience. But it's like, why pick that fight? Because, like, he is old. He did look tired. And even if he didn't freeze, like, what's going to help the age issue is showing, because I think what the age issue is a proxy for is people worried that he is not up to taking the decisive action that we need right now. And so whenever they can show Joe Biden taking those actions, right? Like, this was in the same event, right? So, like, all these Democrats are fighting over the edited whatever. The same event, President Biden, in response to one question, started talking about the Supreme Court and went as far as he's gone in talking about how the stakes of the election are so high when it comes to the Supreme Court, and we've got to, you know, we're going to have two justices nominated for the next president, and here's what I'm going to do, and the courts. And I was like, that, we want to be talking about that, right? He sounded strong. He sounded decisive. So it's like, instead of fighting about whether he froze or not, a couple days later, he takes two immigration actions over the last couple weeks, one on the border that got him some guff from the left, and then this great action where he is helping the spouses of undocumented spouses of American citizens have a pathway to citizenship who've been here for 10 years. And in both those cases, he took strong, decisive action. And I think for voters, they care more that he's doing that than because that can that proves to them that he can do the job and that he's up to the job. And that's going to prove it more than just arguing about it ever will.
Yeah. And is that that's I would imagine be your advice for the debate, too.
It's a show, not tell thing. I also think that he is we have seen him be energetic and feisty at the State of the Union. I thought at the Correspondents' Dinner speech he was like that as well. I think in some interviews he's like that. So he's obviously going, I'm sure, in debate prep right now. I'm sure like it'll be top of mind to be like punchy, energetic, all that kind of stuff. But I do think like it's a show not tell, and it's about him being feeling the sense of urgency of the moment, right? If I truly believe, and I know Joe Biden believes, and a lot of voters believe, that this election, you know, Donald Trump and MAGA represent an existential threat to our way of life in this country. If we believe that, then we got to act like it, right? And the words we use have to convey that sense of urgency. Mm-hmm. And if Joe Biden's up there and he's communicating that, like, this is a going down this road again is a threat to this country, mm-hmm. but I know there's a way out, and there's a way out together, and I can take us there, like, that's going to work, you know?
And then one California question. Sure. What do you make of our governor, and what do you think of him as a presidential candidate, Gavin Newsom?
I really like Gavin Newsom. And I say that because when I first came out here, I like wasn't sure, because he's like, you know, it's just he's got a look, right? That makes you think like he's like the, I mean, you know, right? You've talked to him a bunch of times. He's like the biggest policy nerd. He like really
People
cares.
Don't get that about him.
He's
yeah.
a really good communicator. He thinks deeply about like how to, I love that he goes on Fox. I love that he like mixes it up. We did the Sean Hannity thing, like, you know, like a bit of a stunt, but like good for him. Mm-hmm. I think it's tough as a national candidate for any governor of California. Mm-hmm. But look, it's like, we need really effective, strong communicators in this party. And I'm very excited that he has like risen to that challenge. And so, yeah, we'll see. But I wouldn't be surprised if he ran. But I think that, like, you know, we could do a lot worse than someone that smart and that talented in communicating.
As we wrap things up with Jon Favreau, the co-author of Democracy or Else, on the issue is we have a little bit of fun. We play this game called Personal Issues, where okay. we do your rapid fire, your personal favorites,
Great.
Cultural favorites to get to know you a little bit. So first thing that comes to mind, what is your favorite TV show?
Oh, favorite TV show. Succession.
What is your favorite kids movie?
Inside Out.
Oh,
we just
great.
Watched Inside. We got Charlie through almost all of it.
The new one or the?
The first one.
The first
yeah,
one.
That
okay.
was, we watched it just before the new one came out.
Very nice.
Yeah.
What's your favorite book? Other than, of course, Democracy or Else.
My favorite book. That's a great question. You know, I'll give you my favorite book that got me into politics as a kid, which was All Too Human, George Stephanopoulos' book.
It's a great, great
yeah.
book. Yeah, and yeah. so honest. And then you end up kind of becoming that guy, which is wild.
It inspired me to get into
yeah.
politics.
Are you a big West Wing fan?
I am.
Yeah. Favorite sports team? I think I know the answer.
Red Sox.
There you go. Who is your favorite Pod Save America co-host?
Yeah, right. Nice try.
Yeah, yeah. What is the best thing about being a Californian?
Honestly, everything. I'm just going to say, like, I thought I would be East Coast for life, from Boston, lived in D.C. for 10 years. I was like, what, California? And it's cheesy to say the weather, but, like, I think it is, it's so wonderful to wake up every day and walk around in this city. Like, I really do. I'm here for life. My family's here. My parents moved from Boston. They're in Thousand Oaks. My brother is here. He lives in the Valley. And Emily's sister lives down in Orange County. So, like, we now all have roots out here. And we'll be here for a long time.
It's not as bad as some cable primetime hosts say.
It is not at all.
Yeah.
No.
And finally, Jon Favreau, who is your role model?
My role model, honestly, like it's gonna sound cheesy, but like I still like look up to Barack Obama in a big way, and I always have, and it's just because he wasn't just my boss. He was like a mentor to me, and everyone's always like, how did you write for a guy who writes that well? I mean, it was a gift that I got to learn about writing from one of the best, and he was always so patient with me, and in all these like very high stress, high pressure situations, he never lost patience, he never yelled at me, and he just cares a lot, and he sort of taught me the way I see the world and the way I see politics is really based on what I learned from him.
I mean, we talked about what he taught you, but what do you think made him so exceptional as a politician
yeah.
to be able to beat
the Bush family, the Clinton family, these massive dynasties, to go toe-to-toe with all these different people, to be the first black president. What was it about him?
I've come to think that he has a very finely honed sense of empathy. And I think the reason he has that is he's biracial. So he's had a foot in so many different worlds, right? So black, white, Kansas, Hawaii,
Indonesia.
Indonesia. He's been to some of the poorest neighborhoods, you know, organizing in Chicago, wealthy school like Punahou in Hawaii, right? Like he's got family from Canada and Chinese Canadians, like all over the world. So I think because he is of so many different worlds, he understands that to persuade and to move people, you have to meet them where they are. You have to try to put yourself in their shoes and then bring them along. And I think that's the most important skill in politics. And that's his whole life tells that story, which is why I think was able to succeed.
Well, John, congrats on all your success. It's really incredible what you've built with Crooked.
Thank you.
And I think the most important work you've done, though, is with Vote Save America and this ability of bringing people into politics from all different walks of life around the country and getting them involved in the system is, I think, the most important thing. And I hope that's a huge part of your legacy because it's really important work.
Well, thank you. And I'm just really grateful for our team here who puts it together and runs it, and also just all the people who have signed up and given their time and energy to this, because it's what we need right now.
And all the proceeds from this book, Democracy or Else, goes to Vote Save America to help get people more involved in politics.
That's right.
John Favreau, so great to talk to you on The
Thank
Issue.
You.
Thanks so much
this
for having
fun.
Us.
Thank you.
Our thanks to John Favreau. We've been trying to get the Crooked guys on this show for 6 years, and so we're so glad that it finally happened. And based off what you just heard there, it is worth the wait. Reminder again that we did a whole special show about the debate. We hope you check that out. It's a separate podcast. Next week on the pod, another one of the hosts of one of the most popular podcasts in America, Kara Swisher, is going to be with us to talk tech and a whole lot more. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Hope you like us, subscribe, tell people about us, review, all the good stuff. And we'll see you next week for more of The Issue Is.